Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
And we end today with a conversation about mental health and wellness and humor and irreverence and brain surgery while you're awake. That's because we talked earlier this week with Susie Becker. She is a local author, an illustrator, a cartoonist for The New Yorker, and you might know her from her hit book, All I Need to Know, I Learned from My Cat, which sold over 2 million copies. But after a writing fellowship and a brain tumor, and don't worry, she'll explain it all, she eventually found herself using her skills to help children and adults articulate and deal with the critical voices in their heads. And that's important because a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control raised even more alarms about youth mental health in the country. For example, over half of teen girls in the U.S. felt persistent sadness or hopelessness in 2021. A reminder that if you are having a mental health crisis or you're worried about someone who is, you can call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 988. So we sat down with Susie in Studio 2 earlier this week, and I started by asking her about the giant leap from a funny book on your cat to helping with the mental health crisis.
Okay. How much time do we have? No. Wrote the cat book, wrote a couple other humor books. I was really ready to write in a different form, which I couldn't explain to my publisher. It was more how I think as a cartoonist, a little bit longer text and illustration. So I applied for a creative writing fellowship at Harvard. Thought I'd never get it. I get this thin envelope, which to me meant rejection, got it. And then I was euphoric. And in my euphoria, I didn't celebrate. I stayed up cleaning my baseboards and things. Ended up having a seizure.
Oh, my.
Ended up finding out that I needed brain surgery. So they scheduled it, and I had an awake surgery. Seemed to be going well. I asked them as they're getting ready to close up, because I didn't want them to distract it, to put some music on. I couldn't get the words out at the time. So that surgery kind of unexpectedly wiped out my speech, reading, and writing. And Harvard was kind enough to put a couch in my office, but I couldn't work on the book project I thought I'd work on. So I started writing what I thought was going to be a chapter about my brain surgery, or a short piece, and it ended up being an illustrated memoir called I Had Brain Surgery, What's Your Excuse? So I tore that for 20 cities, and, there's a literary crowd that's there. But there's also a small group of people who are survivors, and those people came up of brain surgery, brain injury, cancer, things like that. And they thanked me for writing this book because my experiences, which I detailed, they had felt really alone in theirs. They'd never read anything like it. And they also found the humor of the book and the irreverence of the book. You know, it's hard to make a joke about brain surgery or brain tumor if you haven't had one, probably, I'm assuming.
Although I have to say, I have not. I have to say, there is something inherently funny about the idea that while you're in the middle of brain surgery, you're awake and you're requesting Spotify, basically,
yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah. And I was also conscious, like, don't put the music on now because you want them to be focused. Now that you guys are done, you just have to close me up. Let's get the music going. And the other thing that I thought was funny about my approach, actually, the only way I could became, I'd never had any kind of medical experience. So someone says awake brain surgery, it's really frightening. But I became comfortable with it because I'm somewhat of a control freak. So I thought, this is good because if things are going wrong, I will simply reach up.
Me out.
Yeah, get the instruments and fix it myself,
You're freaking me out. Okay, we have to move on from
all right,
the,
right.
Your skull is open.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's all closed. No, it's closed. You can feel the...
No. All right.
So, anyway.
So yeah, we get the sense for your irreverence, right? I've got to get your mental frame.
All right.
So then where do we get to the mental health? So you realize that all these survivors are feeling isolated, alone,
terrified, and I thought... And I really didn't write the book for that experience. I really wrote it sort of as this armchair travel memoir, like running with scissors or anything. I thought people would be interested from that point of view. But what I realized when I'm out there is that there is a lot of people who are very scared and alone in their experiences. And that really struck me. And I thought about what writing and drawing about my experience did for me in terms of the catharsis it provided and the ability to kind of take control of the story. Kiese Lehmann talks about the author of Heavy, about how, you know, telling the story is one thing, but framing and reframing and choosing the words allows you to order and reorder your story and actually can reorder your pathways about your story. So it gives you a feeling of more control over it.
You can rewire yourself in your version of your story.
So I also then get to this. I was asked to be on a panel to speak about the book at a writing conference. And someone comes up to me and says, you know, that there's this field of narrative medicine, which is the telling of stories of illness, health, caregiving, and stuff. There's a form of this called graphic medicine, which is illustrated narratives. And I had written this book years before that term was coined. But I'm thinking, wow, this is something that I'd like to do with people because of all the benefits then that are associated with it. And it's not just the catharsis, but I mean, the laughter thing, we know there's medicine behind laughter. There's, you know, nitrous oxide that's released and it reduces your blood vessels and your blood pressure and de-stresses and all of that. There, in working with drawing and writing, you form different neural pathways on your brain.
I want to take a break there for a second because... Yeah. So we've done a segment on graphic medicine on Radio Boston before, and we'll link to that on our website. But even having done that, I was having trouble picturing, right, until I saw some of your material.
Oh, great.
Which really was. So picture something that is the size and shape of a PowerPoint slide, right?
Yeah.
But that has, it's got some sketches and balloons overhead and people are talking, but also printed text that is citations from research. I mean, this is the way the brain works. Like, I felt like I was seeing a snapshot of your brain, which obviously we've already talked about you having open brain surgery, but this combination of pictures and musings and facts and writing kind of all situated the way they are on the page feels to me like your brain went bleh and put it on a page and now I'm looking at it.
I wish it did. It's a lot easier than having to do the work. But yeah, and that's what I wanted to do and that's what I couldn't explain to my publisher. And I did it in this form, but then I did it again about the baby decision and getting pregnant and early parenting, a much
You wrote a book
topic.
About that. Yeah.
Yeah.
If we call it, I mean, right? We don't even quite have the language because is write a book the right language here?
It is. You know, making a book, maybe. And that's what it is. You know, and then this whole term of graphic medicine, now that there's sort of increased attention to it, people are saying what it is and what it isn't. And I could so care less about that because anybody I can sit down with to get them to even do think about COVID and a balance sheet of pluses and minuses or assets and, you know, debts from that experience, which most of us haven't taken the time to do, brings them, you know, gives them either some sense of peace of mind or reveals to them something that they gained from that experience or something they forgot to mourn that was a loss.
Perspective.
Yeah.
So now you're doing these workshops.
Yeah.
And I want to stay in the kids space.
Sure.
On these workshops. And these are really designed to use these techniques to help kids get in touch with kind of... And some listener is going to hear this as glib. It's not. It's a framing for kids.
Right.
The monsters in their heads.
Sure. It is. And it isn't. I mean, I think if we're honest, we have them to this day. And I think that's what's somewhat startling to adults to hear that kids have them. But it's not the very first thing I'll do in that workshop. The first thing I'll do with kids is have them get out some Crayola crayons and talk about feelings that they associate with emotions. And then they'll start to see that different kids associate different feelings with different emotions and different kids need different things when they're sad or angry or whatever. And we get to that key point that a lot of adults also don't remember. It's that, like, when someone's sad or angry, you don't do for them what you do for yourself. You have to find out what works for them. So we do that as an
meaning whatever you might do for yourself may not work for the other person.
Exactly. Like, maybe I want to play games or hear jokes when I'm upset, but somebody else may just want you to sit quietly next to them, you know, shoulder to shoulder and look at a fire or whatever it is. So anyway, kids get that. And I think, and they start to learn, most importantly, what to to how to articulate what they need for themselves. But going to that monster thing, I talk about, you know, as soon as I bring it up, I said, that's that voice in your head that might tell you.
I know that voice.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, how early was it when we had that voice? Well, these are third graders who have this voice, and they're talking about failing, or they're talking about being overweight, or and they are able to draw it and give it qualities. And then I have them read about this monster, what the speech bubbles say, in very silly voices to kind of take away some of the power from that monster.
I want to play a little sound for our listeners to understand this. So you were able to bring us some sound from a workshop you did at Florence Sawyer Elementary in Bolton. We got permission from the parents. And this is, so Sophia Burgess.
Yes.
Her monster is called Peanut.
Yes.
And here is Sophia telling us what Peanut says.
Peanut says, you can't do this, you are overweight. But I just brush that off, and he tries to destroy everything in his way, and he doesn't want people to make friends.
And I'm going to play one other. So another student is Emma Lacomi, same workshop. And here she is saying what her monsters, and her monster sort of looks like a spiked blueberry. We have pictures
blueberry
here.
Blueberry marshmallow.
There we go, with spikes on its head. And here is Emma saying about what her monster says.
You can't do it. You'll get it wrong. Like when there's a question, but I think I know it, but then I'm like, then it says that you can't do it. You'll get it wrong. Because it happens when I don't know if it's right or not. But I want to, try.
We do know that voice.
Oh, yeah.
And so how do you help kids? I mean, what strikes me in listening to both those kids is the first half is what the monster says.
Right.
And the second half is their skill in shutting the monster down.
Exactly. And just by getting it out and onto the paper and having it there, so now sometimes if that monster comes to visit, their teacher can say, oh, I think the monster's there.
So their teacher knows and can help.
Oh, yeah. And the teacher knows what every kid's monster is, whereas before the teacher doesn't know what's keeping that child from raising their hand necessarily. So it's as soon as we can realize that we always told to, we'll use our voice. I want to hear this in your voice. We have so many voices. And that's what's also great about graphic, you know, medicine and graphic memoirs, that you can personify these voices or create little characters for them. In addition to that, in addition to being able to parse out those voices, I can say to them another thing, which, you know, here we are. We're saying we have these voices. We're always told not to make those voices go away, silence them. We can't. Unfortunately, they're going to be with us. So all we can do, I tell them, is acknowledge that they're there. Like sometimes if you see somebody at a party and you know them, or somebody on the playground, you know them, you're not going to want to hang out with them. You acknowledge that they're there, and then don't give them part of your snack, or don't ask them to sit next to you. Just acknowledge that they're there and try and move on. And that's when they come up with their own ways to respond to these voices.
You also have them draw hearts, and I'm going to give a little bit of sound. So Sophia had the monster named Peanut, and then she drew a heart. Here's her describing what's in that heart.
So I drew my cat, my dog at the top, my parents, but I did a line through them because they're not together anymore. But then in the middle, I have me because you should always love yourself.
Good for her for loving herself.
Oh,
tell us about the hearts. I'm sorry. No, tell us about Sophia.
Well, she just stole my heart. And I have to tell you, when I talked to her about the fact that her picture and her monster had been chosen, she was thrilled. But so she, you know, her parents were going through a divorce, and I have them draw the heart in that aftermath of the monster, not for distraction, but to say that there are things that we can turn to, that we can think about, that we love and that we know, you know, love us, and that can help us go forward.
You do this with adults too.
I do with adults. This part I do in a different way. I talk about, I don't know if I want to give this one away.
You don't have to.
Yeah, I talk about I talk about the weight of the world, how many of us feel overwhelmed, that we're flattened by the weight of the world. And I have us, I have adults, you know, draw and spell out what that is with themselves flattened. And I do that person in the middle of the page. But then what I have them do is turn it over and say, well, what lifts us up, you know?
You know, I'm mindful of the CDC report that came out in February about just the really rough state of mental health for girls, teenagers in particular. Yeah. Up to 1 in 3 had contemplated dying by suicide.
Yeah.
And I will note, if you or somebody that you love is having a mental health crisis or thinking about suicide, there's a mental health hotline 24/7. You can call it. You can text it. The number is 988. It feels like this is an urgent moment to create not only that kind of awareness and skills in kids, but this presence of other adults in their lives who understand what's going on and have a better clue about how to be supportive and respond. This feels powerful.
It is. You know, and I have done a lot of things in my life, and that's why I found, you know, this is incredibly powerful. You see it return to the kids, you see it return to the teachers, and it certainly returns to me. And it is a moment, and it's clear that we have to be connecting with kids about these things much earlier on, so we don't have isolated teens and teens depending on other isolated teens for support. And I think what we know about mental health stuff now is that it really is going to be with the crisis in mental health care workers and professionals at the highest levels. That's another aspect to it, but we need to be taking care of each other at the community level. And teachers, as soon as that report came out, you know, teachers are going to be called on to step up. And, you know, you think about, well, I don't want to get into my education system overhaul thing, but you think about what teachers are paid to do, and we're now going to ask them to step in as mental health care workers, and they need to. I mean, they're going to need that training. Social-emotional toolkits for teachers, social-emotional toolkits, they're powerful things. And it's for kids who don't consider themselves necessarily writers. They don't have to consider themselves artists. You sit down with crayons and a pencil, and you just do it. And there are other aspects to it, but at the end, and this is where I could get in trouble with the graphic medicine police, because you start to overlap into stuff that's kind of therapeutic. But you know, graphic medicine at the moment is viewed as it's being opened up as moment is being viewed as a genre of literature in a way. But I do, you know, having kids draw spirals starting and this can be work for adults, you know, spirals starting in the very middle and spiraling out where there's no perfectionism that plays into it, or drawing circles repeatedly, which is something that a Japanese artist did when he was grieving. And, you know, there are all kinds of things you can do then for self-calming that the teachers who have done this workshop can use when a kid's emotionally dysregulated before they can even start to talk or draw.
And are you better at dealing with the monster in your own head now?
I wish I was. I think that whole notion of not inviting them for tea, or I don't even like tea, so coffee. Yeah.
Hot, by the way, for me.
Yeah, exactly. Although if that agent who only drinks iced coffee is listening. Oh, sorry. It's that. It's just acknowledging. As someone once said to me too, it's your ego. And when I look at it that way, and then I think, well, I'm not so humble then. You know, it's there it is as part of me. Just try and move on.
Susie Becker is an author, an illustrator, a cartoonist for The New Yorker, and helping young people and adults explore the worlds of their own minds through art. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tiziana. It was a pleasure.
That was Susie Becker, local writer, illustrator, and cartoonist for The New Yorker.